Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the power of persuasion, the hidden persuaders, when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Well, it's pretty obvious that something must be wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they teach these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national consciousness. Now, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America, at least, that teaches the entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties, and the 33 benefits for the observance of the Ten Commandments. Now, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call it the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works like AIDS, herpes, or VD, which just happened to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. The Hidden Persuaders. A fellow by the name of Vance Packard wrote a book called The Hidden Persuaders back in 1958. The Power of Persuasion. How do you persuade people that what you believe is correct? You're right and they're wrong. And who gives a rat's rectum one way or the other? Why do you even care? Well, not too long ago, I received a letter, and then the guy asked me this question. He said, I believe what you're telling me is the truth. I've researched it out and checked up on you, and I'm convinced that what you're telling us is true, speaking of the economy, speaking of Bible prophecy, speaking of the coming war with Iran, and so on. And he said, I'm trying to tell my children and tell my wife and tell my coworkers at work and trying to tell my fellow church members, and they don't listen to me. They're not paying attention. And he wanted to know, how do you persuade these people? I guess we should start the dialogue by asking the question, why do you even care? I mean, think about it pragmatically. Does everybody in the world know what you know? And if the other people in the world don't know what you know, why is it so important to you to communicate to them that information? Why do you feel like you've got this great mission in life that you just have to fulfill? This power of persuasion, this need that all of us have to convince other people that we're right and they're wrong, isn't unique just to this one fellow who wrote this letter, who, by the way, I lost your letter, partner. I apologize for that. So I'm not going to write you a response. I can't. I don't know who you were, but I remember your letter. You wrote it here about a month or so ago. And it isn't that your letter is unique. Your letter is very common. In fact, students come in here and they will tell me, they'll say, my two daughters that live in Ohio, what am I going to do to convince them so that I can protect them, so that I can save them from themselves? Well, they obviously don't feel that there's any great danger, because if they thought there was any great danger, they would be moving heaven and earth to save themselves. Back in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church had a mission in life. They believed, that is, many Catholics, I'm not saying all did, but many Catholics believed that the Protestants had made a wrong turn. And they needed to save these Protestants, they needed to save their souls from eternal damnation. And in order to do that, they locked these Protestant heretics up in barns, set the barns on fire, and burned these people to death. Whole families, men, women, and children. Because of their heresy. Well, you've got to be pretty serious, you know, when you take people, whole families, and lock them up in buildings and burn them up. Now, you know, you've got to be pretty serious in your belief system, don't you? Now, over in Northern Ireland, you have this constant struggle between Catholics and Protestants, and each side has their beliefs and their belief system. You see, emerging on the world scene today, this titanic struggle between Muslim theology, Muslim belief, and Christian theology and Christian belief. The West versus the East. There's about 1 billion Christians in the world, and there's about 1 billion Muslims, you know, give or take a few. And these two great masses of people are busily out knocking on people's doors and trying to persuade them that what they believe is the truth and what you believe is false, and we've got to save you from something. We're going to save you from hell, or we're going to save you from poverty. You know, politicians, they want to save people from poverty. Now, rich people, you know, they're going around like Presidents Clinton and President Bush. They want to save people from AIDS. President Clinton has a foundation. President Bush proposed, and I'm not talking about the elder Bush, and I'm talking about the current president, proposed that America spend, I think, $15 billion, I think if I remember the numbers right, to fight or combat AIDS. President Clinton, the former president, has a foundation. He's running around the world right now trying to save people from AIDS. He has a belief system. He's trying to alert everybody in the world to this great danger of AIDS. And then there's other people out there trying to alert everybody in the world to the great dangers of deforestation. And then there's others, they want to alert you to the 3 million people that die from malaria every year. And we want to stamp out polio. And we've got these messages. How many of these are there? My God, there must be thousands of these important messages, thousands of these important beliefs. I think AIDS is a very serious disease, and I think people need to be informed about it. And I think malaria is a very serious disease, and people need to be informed about it. And so is polio, and you know, there's 55 diseases out there. And people like Bill Gates are donating millions of dollars and spending umpteen hours of their time trying to alert you, trying to persuade you, trying to get you to know something about their particular cause. And the problem that I see is that we don't have enough time in our lifetimes to be alerted to deforestation of the rainforests in Brazil and the consequences of it. Along with 1,000 other topics over there, much less, what am I going to do about it? There's poverty all over the world, and there's 20,000 people starving to death worldwide every day. Yeah, but what's George Gordon going to do about it? I mean, I could get on the air, and I could alert all of you people and get you real excited. I could get you to jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and send money to this or that charity, and it might do a little good. Shucks, you might be able to feed somebody a few meals. But over the long haul, is it going to make any real difference? Let's take a subject like desertification. In North Africa, in the Sahara Desert, there's over 3 million square miles of real estate that has just been turned into a desert over the past 2,000 years. I say just, you know, over a long period of time. But it's being converted to a bigger desert at the rate of 100 square miles a year, year in and year out. Every year that goes by, the Sahara gets bigger by 100 square miles. Over in China, the Gobi Desert is growing. I don't have any numbers on how fast it's growing, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised by what it's 100 square miles a year. And 100 square miles, that's 100 sections. That's a mile square, 100 of those, in two locations in the world. And then you got the rainforest that's being deforested at the rate of 4,000 square miles a year. That's like two states of Delaware every year, four states of Rhode Island. You know, little postage stamp states, little small pieces of real estate, but you know, you stick them down in the middle of the Amazon basin or the middle of the Belgian Congo, and you just keep expanding those every year. It amounts to a lot. Then the population of the world is growing at prodigious rates. About 100 million people a year are being added to the population. So you've got a growing population, and you've got less and less land available to grow food on to feed those people. Now, what's that tell you? I mean, you know, just extrapolate it out into the future. Now, a guy by the name of Malthus back in the 1700s did the arithmetic, and he said, well, you got more people to feed. They're growing geometrically or exponentially, and you've got land that's coming into production arithmetically, and there's a finite amount of land but an infinite amount of people. Therefore, there's going to come a mass starvation. And Malthus is correct. Malthus is 100% true, accurate, and correct. Now, it hasn't happened yet, and so there's a story called The Little Boy That Cried Wolf. Remember that story? The Little Boy Cried Wolf. And just to reiterate, you know, for a couple of you that maybe never heard this story, you know, there's people over in Bangladesh and India and around the world that listen to this program, and they probably haven't heard these little nursery rhymes that we have here in the United States. So bear with me if you've heard the story. But the story goes like this. A little boy was tending the sheep, and he was bored one day, and he thought, well, I think I'll just cry wolf. So he said, wolf, wolf, there's a wolf after the sheep. And so he ran into town. Now he's crying wolf, and so the people of the town grabbed their pitchforks and grabbed their swords and staves and spears, and they ran out into the countryside, and then they looked all around. There was no wolf, and the little boy laughed and laughed and laughed, and he thought, well, that was pretty funny. So he, one day he's out there, he's watching the sheep again, and he got bored again one day, so he ran into town, and he cried, wolf, wolf, the wolf is after the sheep. And so the people ran out, and again there was no wolf. And the little boy did this a couple, three times, and he's just having a good time. Of course, these sheep are pretty important, you know, to people, especially if you're poor. And I imagine this is one of those stories where the people are very poor and they're very concerned about their sheep. And so one day the little boy is out tending the sheep, and a wolf came. And the wolf is chasing the sheep. And so the little boy rushes into town, and then he yells, wolf, wolf. And the people say, now you're not going to fool us again. And so the people did not go out to chase the wolf or to catch the wolf. And sure enough, the wolf got into the sheep, and he killed a bunch of them. It's called the story of the little boy who cried wolf. Well, we apply that story now. If you've been warned about something, like the second coming of Christ, and you have heard this story all your life, Jesus could come tonight. That's Billy Graham. Christ could come tonight. Now, that's not what the Bible says at all. Christ is not coming tonight. And the reason I know that is because in Matthew 24, he gave a series, you know, his disciples came up to him one day and he said, hey, boss, give us a little information here. Tell us when you're coming back. And he said, well, gather around, boys, and I'll tell you the story. You can read it for yourself in Matthew 24. It's not rocket science. It's not some great theological mystery there. They ask him a pretty straightforward question, and for the rest of the chapter, he gave him some pretty straightforward answers. And there are some events that he described that would occur before his second coming that have not occurred yet, such as over there at the temple. He said, now you see this temple. Do you see these stones? These great stones. He said, not one of these stones will be left on top of another. Boys and girls, there's a place over there called the Wailing Wall, and the Jews go over there and they pray all the time in front of the Wailing Wall. That Wailing Wall has to come down. Well, it's either that or Jesus lied or didn't know what he was talking about. You know, you can decide for yourself who you want to believe, but I didn't write it. I'm just referring you to it. So I don't believe Jesus is coming tonight. I'm waiting for that Wailing Wall to get knocked down. Now, one of these days, I think those Palestinians or Arabs or somebody is going to get pretty excited over there, and they're probably going to go over there and knock them down. Hell, the Jews may go over there and knock it down themselves and build a new temple. They've got the material to build it. One of these days when the time's right, I think they're going to build a temple over there. Now, do I need to convince you that I'm right? Do I need to persuade you? Is there some great crying need that I have to persuade you that you need to take action on the rainforest or desertification or AIDS or the second coming or, you know, do I have some great compelling need? And my conclusion is that no, I don't have any great compelling need to do that. So I've taken a little different tack in life. I'm not trying to persuade you that I'm right. I really don't care whether you believe anything I tell you. It's no skin off my back, as one old teacher used to say. It's no skin off my back, one way or the other. Now, I think people should be alerted to the AIDS problem, and I've been alerted to the AIDS problem. And so far, I've been able to solve the AIDS problem for myself and for my family. I don't know a whole lot about AIDS. I'm not an expert on AIDS. I've read two or three books on AIDS. And I've got five children, and when I read Lorraine Day's book on AIDS, I went out and bought five Lorraine Day books, and I sent those five books to my five children. Now, that's how important I thought that was. So I wanted to check up and find out how had my children received this information. This is many years ago now, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, whenever Lorraine Day, and this Dr. Lorraine Day, now she's quite a lady, she's got a website, it's called drday.com. And a pretty knowledgeable lady about health and nutrition and food and AIDS and disease and things like that. I think she was a surgeon, as I recall. She was in fact a pretty top surgeon. She was a high up. I don't know exactly how you'd word this in the medical field. You know, a high up muckety muck in the San Francisco General Hospital, as I recall. Anyway, she wrote this book, and I read her book, and boy, I was really motivated. I got real excited. I told my wife, and my wife read it. And we took some immediate action. In fact, we followed Dr. Day's advice, and it's worked pretty well for 15 years. None of us in our family has gotten AIDS. So, Dr. Day, you did me a great service. Your book was worth, I don't know what it cost for your book, 20, 30 bucks, whatever it was. It was worth every penny to me. To avoid getting AIDS, I think it was worth it. Now, I checked with my children, and not one of them read the book. So I spent the 20 or 30 bucks, sent the book to my children, called them up on the telephone and said, Elaine, I sent you a book. Did you read it? Well, yeah, Dad, I got the book. No, I haven't read it yet. So there you are. It wasn't important to her. She hasn't gotten AIDS yet, to my knowledge. And she's probably not going to take any evasive action to avoid getting AIDS. other than what she learns over CBS or ABC. And you know, I hope that the things work out well for her. But you know, she's a grown woman now. She's in her 30s. She's a CPA. She's got her own family. She's married and went away from home. And, you know, she's an adult and she can make decisions for herself. And I don't need to persuade my daughter that I'm right and that she needs to get real excited about AIDS. Now, one of these days, because of her ignorance concerning AIDS, maybe there's something she doesn't know that she ought to know, and she may come down with AIDS. And if she does, she will be the proximate cause of her own injury. As we say in law, the proximate cause of your own injury. As my old granny used to say, you made your bed, sweetheart, now go sleep in it. But people, and especially students here, they get evangelistic zeal. They learn about the Federal Reserve, and by God, I'm going out here, and I'm going to tell everybody about the Federal Reserve. Or they learn about the income tax, and they say, well, God, what a fraud. I'm going out here and inform everybody about the income tax. And, of course, people get religion. And when they get religion, they say, well, by God, I'm going to go out here, and I'm going to tell everybody about those Catholics. I'm going to tell everybody about these Baptists. I'm going to go out here and tell everybody what I've just learned. They get excited about that. I call it evangelistic zeal. And some of it's well-placed, and some of it's pretty poorly placed. You know, when you're locking people up in buildings and burning them to death, I think that's pretty poorly thought out. Muslims, they get real excited. They're over there blowing themselves up in, for their cause. You know, they believe fervently in it. Americans are over there in Iraq fighting a war, and they believe fervently in it. Well, those that believe in the war believe in the war, and those that don't believe in the war do not believe fervently in it. But the people are out here are marching around with placards and signs, and they're always trying to persuade people to do something. Salesmen are great persuaders. Salesmen operate off of these five principles. It's called vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. So we in the sales profession, when we want to sell you something, we know that we have to appeal to your vanity, or we have to appeal to your jealousy. We have to appeal to your lust or your greed or your fears. So in order for us to do that, we also know that we need to tell you what it is that you want to hear, and we need to avoid telling you what you don't want to hear. Preachers are great salesmen. Preachers tell you what you want to hear. In fact, when you look in the Bible at this very subject, you know, the Apostle Paul made an observation concerning preachers and people. And it's over here in 2 Timothy. See if I can find it here. 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 4, verses 3 through 5. Let me just give you a little illustration as to what he had to say here. 2 Timothy, just a quick letter over here. He said in 2 Timothy 4, verse 3, says, the time is going to come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. I look around the world and I watch people. I watch the Muslims, and I think they've been turned to fables. I watch the Christians, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews aren't Christians, but you know, I just watch these various religious groups. From my perspective, from what I see, I think they've been turned to fables. Now, if you were to ask them, what do they think of George Gordon? They would say, boy, that prophecy has come to pass in your ears. That guy Gordon has been turned to fables. He's got itching ears. He's a false prophet. Probably he's the Antichrist. So what do I want to go around here standing on my soapbox trying to convince these people that I'm right when they talk about me behind my back and say that I'm the Antichrist or that I'm this or that or something else? Had a guy in class the other day, we're chit-chatting, and he says, how many people know this? And I said, well, my guess would be that here in America, probably 200,000 to 300,000 people in the entire nation probably know this. He kind of shook his head, and he said, my God, how are we going to inform everybody in America to the danger that we're in? And I said, we're not. And he said, well, my God, if these people don't know about this danger, they're all going to be swallowed up by it. And I said, that's right. That's right. They are. Now, let me tell you a little story here. Back in World War II, just prior to World War II, there was a guy named Hitler running around Europe. And one day he woke up and he said, I think I'll just go in here and take apart a Czechoslovakia. So he did, about 1936. And a guy by the name of Winston Churchill, you might have heard that name, Winston Churchill, he was the World War II English Prime Minister. He got real excited about Hitler. And he started writing newspaper articles. I think he was a writer at the time. He was kind of between jobs, as I recall. And he started writing about Hitler. He said, you know, we're headed for another world war, just like World War I. We Englishmen had better wake up to this menace that's going on. And not very many people listened to Winston Churchill. And they had a prime minister, his name was, I believe it was Clement Attlee, if I remember the name right, if I got my story straight here. Clement Attlee. No, it was Chamberlain, wasn't it? Chamberlain, he was the prime minister. Anyway, he came back from Germany, he went over and talked to Hitler, and he said, He said Attlee was a British Prime Minister, but he's not the one I'm thinking about. It's Chambers. I forgot his first name now, but about 1938 or 39, he came back and says, we've bought peace in our time. And Churchill got real excited about that, and he said, no, you fools, you've been duped. This guy Hitler, he's going to unleash war. And sure enough, you know, it came in September 1st, 1939, Hitler attacked Poland. And all of these events that were going on from 36, 37, 38, and 39 up until the war started were signs that Hitler intended to go to war. And there were people, I mean, Winston Churchill wasn't the only guy, but there was this little small cadre of people who were watching world events and paying attention, and they looked at this and they said, hey, well, we got some bad problems coming up. And it tells us a little something else. People listen to people who tell them what they want to hear. So if you want people to listen to you, you just tell them whatever it is that they want to hear, and they'll love you. Now, you go around telling people things that they don't want to hear, they'll hate you. I mean, that's just the way life is, the way human nature works. So I try not to tell people things that they don't want to hear. That's why I tell you over the air, if this disturbs you in some way and you don't want to hear this, turn it off. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. I only want to talk to people that want to hear what I've got to say. Now, some people have an open mind, and they listen, and they say, well, gee, let me check that out. Now, in the Bible, there's a couple of scriptures, you know, that tell you about this. It talks to you about searching the scripture to see whether or not these things are true. That's why I've said many times, you ought not to believe me or whatever I tell you, because I could be wrong, but you ought to listen to God, because he's pretty accurate most of the time. He's been pretty fair. He's been pretty honest and upfront, and I think that you could probably rely upon that a whole lot more than Georgie Gordon, and why don't you give that a shot? And if you find that I've made a mistake, write me a letter and tell me, and I'll see if I can correct it. But this thing of me trying to convince you that I'm right and you're wrong is a phenomenon that we find in human nature. Everybody's got it. Everybody's got it. So I looked at it years ago and I said, you know, I don't think I'll waste my time buying books and sending books to my children when they don't even read them, because they don't want to know what I know. They're not interested in the same things that I'm interested in. Now, is that going to kill them? More than likely. And that's the thing I think that most people are really concerned about. It's their children or their mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles who are going to die from their ignorance, from information that they need that they don't have and that you have, and you want to communicate that information to them. And if you don't do that, something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, or evil is going to happen to your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your family, and you just feel this compelling need to go out and warn them. All right, hang on. I'm going to show you how to do that when we come back. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through our website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the power of persuasion. How do you persuade people that they're wrong? Well, there's a lot said in the Bible about this very subject matter. And that's why I said to you, there's no need for you to run out here and convince people that they're wrong, because they're not going to listen to you anyway. So why waste your time? How do I know that? And mainly it's over the scripture. And when people learn some new scriptural topic, they learn something, you know, about Bible prophecy or about world conditions, boy, they get really excited, you know, they want to go out and share this with their friends and neighbors. Particularly, they want to share them with their wives. So you run out here and you want to tell your wife, or you run out here and you want to tell your husband. He looks at you and says, Martha, you're nuts. Henry, you're stupid. Who else believes this? And that's a very important factor, because people believe what the majority of people believe. It's the sheep instinct in people. If a great number of people believe something like Social Security, the third rail of politics, then everybody believes in it. Now, I've done some programs on Social Security, and I showed you that mathematically, Social Security is bankrupt. Social Security is not going to be here forever. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. I know that. You know that. But the majority of people do not know that. So the ultimate end result of this will be the same result as happened in Argentina, as happened in Uruguay, as has happened in societies for thousands of years. People will become dependent upon it, and then it will be taken away from them suddenly, and they will become destitute because of it, and they will suffer from it. Many of them will die as a result of it. But it isn't going to destroy Argentina. It didn't destroy Uruguay. And even by itself, the demise of Social Security is not going to destroy the United States of America. There will be a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. There will be a lot of changed votes in the next election. But by and large, people will survive it, and they will not learn anything from it. And they will go on in the future, and they will repeat that same mistake again and again and again. And the old adage that says history repeats itself is exactly true. Mankind has gone through war after war after war after war after war, and all the time that people are going to war, they're talking about peace. In fact, the prophet Jeremiah had a little something to say about that. Jeremiah, they talk about peace, peace, when there is no peace. I think it's about Jeremiah chapter 6. Let me see if I can find that. I was flipping through here a little while ago and see if I'm right. Sacrifices were added. No, I'm not looking for that. Easter, nope, not looking for that. Well, gosh, now I can't put my finger on it. But it was Jeremiah, and he said that when they cry, peace, peace, and there is no peace, you'll know that war is right around the corner. So the more politicians talk about peace, the closer you are to war. Now, they're talking about peace over in Israel and the Palestinians, and you've been in this peace process, and they've been talking about peace and the peace process and peace this and peace that and peace something else. And what do you got over there? You got nothing but war. You got nothing but trouble. And then you hear people, they talk about Jesus, you know, the King of Peace. You ever heard about that? Jesus, the King of Peace? Well, in Matthew 10, verse 34, Jesus had something to say about this thing of peace. Let me read that to you. And then you'll get real excited when you hear this, and you want to run out and you want to tell everybody. See? You'll say, oh my God, I didn't know that. Now, we all know that Jesus is the King of Peace. And we all know that Jesus came to bring peace on earth. And when it's Christmas time, we all talk about peace on earth and goodwill among men, and God would just peace, peace, and more peace, right? Well, in Matthew 10, verse 34, here's Jesus, first person, if you've got a red-letter Bible. He said, verse 34, think not. That means don't think. Put it out of your mind. Get it out of your head. Don't you believe for a minute. Can you understand it? He said, think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. Now, how could all these preachers get that backwards? How come all these preachers are telling you people about peace, peace, and Jesus, the King of Peace, and Jesus this, and Jesus that, and Jesus loves you, and one thing and another? And here's Jesus in the first person. He says, hey, pilgrim, come over here. Let me tell you, put it out of your head. If you think that I've come to bring peace on earth, I want to tell you I came here to bring a sword. And let me tell you, he has succeeded beyond his wildest expectations. There's war in the old Belgian Congo. There is war in Israel and Palestine. There is war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's the threat of war in Venezuela and the threat of war in Iran. There is a civil war going on in Colombia. And the United States is positioning itself in Paraguay right now to dominate and militarily control South America. Then you've got the North Koreans that are armed with a bomb. And, of course, they're out here threatening the United States every other day with how we're going to drop a nuke on Long Beach, California. So if you think there's any peace in the world, could you tell me where it's at? The Catholics and the Protestants aren't shooting each other in Northern Ireland today, but they hate each other just like they always have. All right, so I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, you learned something there that you didn't know before, that Jesus did not come to planet Earth to send peace on Earth. He came here to bring war. He came here to send a sword. He came here to bring trouble. He said plainly, he said, I came to set a man at variance against his father, the daughter against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foe shall be those of his own household. So let me tell you a little story here. I started practicing this law some years back, and let me tell you that I don't have any member of my family that will talk to me in a civil tone to this day. And that includes my five children, my ex-wife, my nieces and nephews and aunts and uncles and everybody else. So when the Messiah said that they'll hate you, in fact, he said they will put you to death and believe that they're doing God a service in the process. Now, that doesn't strike me as being peace. Now, there's another part to the story over here. Remember, I told you the Bible is written in code, and it's not written so that everybody in the world can understand it. Now, if you went to the average Baptist and you said, "Now, Mr. Baptist, I know you read the Bible a lot, but I don't think you understand what you're reading," he'd get real mad at you. He might even kill you. You go to a Catholic and you say, "Mr. Catholic, I think you've been deceived. I think that the Pope's leading you down the primrose path." He's liable to kill you. You go to a Muslim and you say, "I think Allah has let you down. I don't think that you've got the right God. I think something's wrong with your religion." Guy's liable to kill you. People get real excited. If you challenge their belief system, if you say, "Hey, I think you're wrong about this," they don't like you anymore. If you said to somebody, "Oh, you voted for George Bush. I think you made a mistake. I think you ought to change your vote in the next election," he'd get mad at you. People get mad over religion. They get mad over politics. They get mad over just about anything. If your belief system is something different than somebody else's, he didn't like you. I have students that come here and they eat pork, and I don't eat pork. I think it's bad for me. I don't know if it's good for you or bad for you. I let people decide for themselves what they want to eat. I don't serve pork at my table. I feed it to my dog, you know. Once in a while, the wife brings home a can of pork and beans or something by mistake, and I open up, feed it to the dog. But I wouldn't feed it to you. I wouldn't feed it to company. I wouldn't feed it to a guest. I wouldn't feed it to my children. I wouldn't feed it to myself. But people, you know, and I was telling a story here. I was met up with one of my sons here one day. That's been some years back now, and I said, "Well, son, let's go to dinner." And he said, "That's a good idea, Dad." And so we went to dinner. Now, my children all know that I don't eat pork, and I'm buying. And so my boy sits down. He says, "Well, I think I'm going to order pork and scallops and shellfish." And then I had two of them. Both my sons are, not both, but two out of the three. And the two sons are sitting there. And they thought they were going to rub this into the old man a little bit. And I said, "Well, now, boys, I'm buying. And I want you to eat, and I want you to buy anything on the menu. But I don't want you to give me the finger, and I don't want you to stick your finger in my eyeball here and make fun of me. So I'll tell you what I'll do. If you all know that those are unclean, and you all know that that's not right, and you know that I'm opposed to it, and you know that I don't do it, and I think it's just damn rude on your part to come in here on my dime and sit down at my table and order scallops and crab and all these unclean critters and expect me to pay for that. So I'll tell you what you do. You just order anything on there you want. If it's unclean, you pay for it, and if it's clean, I'll pay for it." So I said, "You just eat whatever you want, but you're not going to offend me." And you know, those two boys, when it came down to, "Well, you mean, Dad, we got to buy our own if it's unclean?" I said, "That's right." "Oh, well, in that case, well, then we'll eat clean." And all they're trying to do is to show their independence. What they're trying to do is to show old Dad over here that he's a dunderhead, got his head up the wrong end, and that they're going to show me. Now, they didn't persuade me, and that's not the way to persuade me. And they went about it exactly backwards, and I already knew that I'm not going to persuade them to stop. They've already made up their mind, so why make a big scene up over it? See how that comes down? Now, if somebody wants to stick his finger in my eyeball over here, I'm going to object strenuously. That was the last time I invited those two boys to dinner. I don't know, that was 10, 15 years ago. And hell will probably freeze over before I invite those two boys back to dinner again because they poked their finger in my eyeball. So they didn't persuade me. I didn't persuade them. But listen, I go out with people every once in a while, and some guy sits there and he orders a ham sandwich. I don't get excited and preach him a sermon and say, "Hey, dunderhead, don't you know that that's bad for you?" I don't care what that guy eats. He's not sticking his finger in my eye. And if I'm buying, I'll buy that pig for him. But, you know, if he knew better and stuck his finger in my eye, I'd get a little bit offended at that. So, you know, tit for tat. But let's understand a couple things. First of all, the Bible is written in code. Remember Isaiah 28, verses 9 through 13? Now, here's God himself. He said, "I'm going to write this in such a way that you're not going to be able to understand it." Well, now, if the average Joe Sixpack can't understand it, what in the world makes you think that you're going to make him understand it? What makes you think, if God writes something in code, that you can go around behind God's back and reveal that code to this guy over here when God deliberately put it in code so that he couldn't understand it? Who in the hell do you think you are, anyway? You ever think about that? Now, if information is out there and somebody wants to listen to it and they want to, of their own free will and volition, avail themselves of it, like I mentioned at the beginning of this program, I said there's a lady by the name of Lorraine Day. She wrote a book on AIDS. I thought it was a heck of a good book, and I'm going to recommend her book. And if you go to drday.com, I think that her book will probably be available. If not, you can go to any bookstore. I'm pretty sure it's probably still in print. If it isn't, it ought to be. And I recommend it. But I'm not trying to persuade you that you need to buy it. I don't care whether you buy the book or not. I don't care whether you know anything about AIDS or you don't. It's irrelevant to me. Now, I can understand my concern of my five children, but when my five children all stuck their finger in my eye and said, "We're not going to read your damn book, Dad," okay, I never bought them another book. From that day to this, I have never bought those children another book. Because I know they're not going to read it. There isn't any need for me to go out and blow $30 or $30 on a book and send it off to my daughter. She's not going to read it. So why would I want to cast pearls before swine? Now my daughter's going to send me a letter. She's going to say, now, Dad, you didn't need to call me a pig. Let me point that out to you. Come on here, pig. I wrote this down here. I got a note here. I'm going to find my note. So you just bear with me here. It's in Matthew something or other. I wrote that one down. Matthew 10:34, no peas. Casting pearls. Here it is, Matthew 7, verse 6. Why don't you flip over to that before we get into this Isaiah 28 thing. Here's Matthew 7, verse 6. Listen to this. You want to persuade people about something. Jesus comes along one day and he said, give not that which is holy unto the dogs, and neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and then turn again and rend you. No need for me to take my two boys out to dinner. I know what they think of me. No need for me to send another book to my daughter. I already know what she thinks. And I know why she thinks it. See, these people think I'm stupid. And hell, they're probably right. I'm probably just as dumb as a box of rocks. But I'm perfectly satisfied and perfectly persuaded that I've got the truth and that I believe the truth and that that's right. And they, on the other hand, are just as convinced that they've got the truth and that I'm stupid and that I've been deceived. So here's God comes along and he says, hey, partner, why cast your pearls before swine? I think that's pretty good advice. So I stopped doing that. Now, I'm not trying to tell you that you shouldn't. If you want to go cast pearls before swine, get after it. Don't let me stop you. But I thought I'd share with you, since you wrote me the letter, and you asked me, how do you persuade your children that you're right? And the answer is, you don't. I wasn't able to persuade my five children. What in the hell makes you think that you're going to persuade yours, pilgrim? And why do you even care? And here's what the bottom line to this, why do you even care? And that's because you're persuaded that they're going to go to hell, that they're going to die, like the Catholics, you know, killing all these Protestants back in the Middle Ages, that if we don't kill these guys, they're going to go to hell. I'm not at all persuaded that my daughter or that my two boys are going to go to hell because they're not following after their daddy. They don't need to follow after me, and none of them are going to hell. Well, not Dante Alighieri's hellfire, you know, the Catholic Church's idea of you're going to go here and burn forever for the rest of eternity. You know, you've been a bad guy for about 50 or 60 years, and you died of AIDS, and because of your wickedness and evil, you're going to spend all the rest of eternity. Now, that's thousands of years, millions of years, billions of years, trillions of years in hellfire, being tortured, eternal torture, being burned, but never being burned up, never dying, just always suffering with great pain and anguish and agony for the mistakes that you made over 50 or 60 years. Well, you know, people believe that, but if you believe that, then you'd have to believe that God is some kind of a sadistic monster to take somebody who's made a mistake. Now, I got a boy, two boys, they stuck their finger in my eye, and they said, hey, we're going to order shrimp. My daughter stuck her finger in my eye, and she said, I ain't reading your damn book. I don't think that they should go to hell and be tortured for the rest of eternity because they dishonored their parent a couple of times, because they didn't listen to me. I wouldn't do that to a dog, for crying out loud. I wouldn't do that to somebody I didn't even like. Hell, I love my children. I think they're great children. I really like them. I'm not sure that the feeling is mutual, but then, you know, their choice in life. I got nothing against them. I like them. I think they're great kids. I'm proud of them all. I think they're making some bad choices and making some bad mistakes, and I'd prefer it if they didn't do that, but then, you know, if that's what they want to do, why should I get in their way? So I'm going to avoid casting pearls. My pearls. I've got some pretty good information, but I'm not going to share it with them. I'm not going to waste my time on them. But if they called me on the phone and said, hey, Dad, could you tell me what the answer to this is, or could you explain this to me? One of these boys I'm telling you about called me and he said, Dad, I want to buy a house. Could you give me some pointers on buying a house? I said, yeah, I'm an old-timey general contractor, and I've been in the real estate business for many years. I know a lot, son, about buying houses. I know a lot about building houses, buying houses, remodeling houses, selling houses. And I shared with him some of my knowledge. I don't think it meant very much to him. He didn't call me back and get any more. So obviously he didn't care too much for my ideas, but then, you know, that's the way life is. People make decisions, and sometimes we look at it and we say, well, I think that's a bad decision. He thinks that's a good one. For instance, I think people that have a mortgage on their house made a bad decision. I think you should own your house free and clear. I own my house free and clear. I'm opposed to paying interest. I don't pay any interest. I notice most Americans pay a lot of interest. I think that's a bad decision, but am I going to go out here and preach sermons to everybody? No, stop. Don't pay interest. Don't buy a house. Don't pay on that mortgage. Don't sign that mortgage contract. I don't care. There's a penalty that you pay when you sign that mortgage contract. It's called interest. You buy a house for $50,000 at 8% interest. You buy one house for you and two for the banker. Now, over the next 30 years, if you want to buy three houses, one for you and two for the banker, I can't think of a better methodology to accomplish that goal than for you to sign an 8% mortgage. Get after it. Personally, over the next 30 years, I want to buy three houses, but I want to buy all three of them for me. I want to own all three of them, and the banker can go to hell, or he can freeze to death in the dark, or he can freeze out under a bridge. I'm not buying him a damn house. But if you want to buy him a house or two, I don't care. But remember now, I'm the guy that's not complaining about all these Jewish bankers over here that are taking advantage of you poor Christians, like Martin Luther was, complaining about the Jews charging these Christians interest, taking advantage of them. Those Christians over there were all adults. They all went over there and signed the contract. They all made the mistake of them by themselves. And I've been watching this now over the last 500 years. I haven't seen any changes. If Martin Luther in 1500 was complaining about the Jews and their usury, and people today are complaining about the Jews and their usury, obviously somebody didn't learn anything. I did. I said, oh, that usury, that's bad business. And I found that out in the Bible. I took a look in the Bible under this word usury, U-S-U-R-Y. Just look it up. It appears in the Bible 23 times. Go get Strong's Concordance, partner, and read it. And under usury, and it'll show you 23 times. Go read those 23 scriptures, and I think it'll tell you the story. I am fully persuaded. God succeeded in persuading me that usury is bad for me. He has not persuaded 300 million other Americans that it's bad for them. Now, why is that? And what is it that God Almighty is doing to run around and persuade all of you people that usury is bad and that his non-usury program is good? And if God isn't doing it, why should I? In fact, if I'm not doing it, why shouldn't you? Why should you get all excited and run around out here trying to tell somebody some neat little piece of truth that they don't want to hear? All right, we'll take this up again next time, tomorrow. I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to quit. Let me find my closing argument here. Here it is. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.